This is People's Tribune Radio. I'm Jesus Estrada. Today we are interviewing Joe Wendland from Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace is an organization of U.S. war veterans who have opposed the Persian Gulf War and aggressions in Latin America. They are now organizing against the pending war in Iraq.
People are hurting. I know people who are paying an arm and a leg, literally, you know, hundreds of dollars every week to try to purchase the prescription drugs they need to survive, just to live, right, and to feel less pain, etc. And that money is available. There is enough resources in this country to provide that. But it seems to be the policy of the Bush administration that building weapons of mass destruction is more important than saving people's lives anywhere in the world, here or in any other country in the world.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, which also publishes the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the show. Today's show is conducted from a Veterans Day 2002 interview done on KZU's Community Forum Radio by Tony Zaragoza, a correspondent from Pullman, Washington.
Just days after the attack on the World Trade Center, we all remember there was just this constant barrage of how we had to fight back and attack Afghanistan and punish Afghanistan for the deeds of these particular people who attacked the World Trade Center and other buildings and places in the United States. And began to cast about for a way to, you know, to get past all of that rhetoric. And one of the most effective, it seemed to be, was to use my voice as a veteran. I served in the U.S. Army back in the early 90s during the first Persian Gulf War. And it was interesting that because so many people were into, you know, bombing Afghanistan and there's no alternative and we have to do this, that using my voice as a veteran to counter that, you know, did gain a hearing. So it was an interesting way to get involved in the peace movement. And I eventually volunteered for a program that veterans had put together called Veterans Teaching Peace in Schools. It was sort of an ad hoc program that arose after, you know, in the midst of this talk of bombing Afghanistan, sort of spread through the internet, people in different parts of the country. I don't remember exactly how many people ended up volunteering to go into schools. It was several hundred. And of course, it didn't get any press. But the idea was that people would coordinate and find ways to get veterans who wanted to talk about peace and peaceful alternatives to attacking Afghanistan into schools and into university campuses.
And what has your experience been so far bringing this message as a veteran to various classrooms, to various people? What has the response been?
Kind of a mixed response, especially in the period when people just wouldn't hear any other alternative to bombing hell out of Afghanistan. But it also had a positive side, because people were looking to understand this, and they were not getting it from the U.S. government or the U.S. corporate media, except in very isolated pockets. And they were really honestly looking for a way to end terrorism and to do it without, you know, provoking more by bombing people who had nothing to do with it.
What do you think is behind the current administration's war drives, both in Afghanistan, as we've seen, you know, the destruction of an already devastated country, and what's behind the sort of potential attack, the attack that they're really pushing for on Iraq?
Certainly the key petroleum and petroleum products like oil, natural gas, but also finding ways and geographical space to transport that in pipelines and other things, and needing to have large military forces present in order to protect that. What they've discovered in places like Colombia, well, especially Colombia, the need to have large military forces to protect pipelines for the sake of ExxonMobil, Chevron, Unocal, Enron. Crooked E was involved in the project over there to build pipelines and essentially to sort of rein in and gather in for U.S. corporate interests all these natural resources that they felt as though they had control of under the Taliban, but until they lost control of the Taliban, right? So certainly oil is one of the big projects. There's also another side to it that I don't think we talk about as much, but that's simply, besides the control of natural resources, the spread of the control of geographical space and other natural resources like water and things like that. But I think there is a long-term agenda beyond oil. I mean, I know that even the right wing probably believes that oil is going to run out sooner or later. But, you know, they want to gather that in as much as they possibly can. But I think there's also a longer-term agenda that is related to pushing a U.S. imperialist agenda in that part of the world. And they're finding themselves competing more and more for dominance in the region with other big countries like China, possibly Russia, although Russia seems to sort of want to bend with the will of the U.S. Ruling class and whatnot. But I think one of the long-range targets has to be, in their mind, has to be China. I mean, it's still oriented in a political and economic fashion that is different from U.S. imperialism and in their view, naturally opposed to it. So I think that's part of that agenda as well. And then there are a whole series of shorter term things, like controlling and dominating and influencing the political life in the Middle East and in Central Asia and South Asia is certainly pertinent to each aspect of that, the short and the long-term agenda that they see themselves trying to build, trying to organize. So, and it requires a number of things. It requires political hegemony, but it also requires, in the present period, it is turning out to require large bodies of military personnel in those areas, and they're starting to put those in place. So I think it's both a short and a long-term agenda that includes oil as well as essentially domination.
And what we're seeing is U.S. bases, military bases all around the world in ways that we've never seen before. Well, I'm curious, when you served during the Gulf War, where were you stationed? Where were you?
I was in, at the time that the war started, I was a very patriotic person. I was just 18 years old, and I believed, like most people do, right, without an alternative source of information, without an alternative ideological position, that what we were doing was the right thing. And so I joined, and I was in basic training, actually, when the war was going on, and it ended, and I, due to a number of events, became quickly disillusioned by the whole thing. But after I left basic training, after the war was gone, and I was stationed first in South Korea and then in Louisiana. There was a big push. There was a hyper, I don't know, ad campaign, so to speak, a publicity campaign, public relations campaign to get young men to get involved and get into the service and to be willing to do all of these things. And it was an emotional campaign, it was a patriotic campaign, etc. But it also was a class campaign because coming from a working class background, I had these ambitions about going to college and making something of myself, etc., but I had no resources to do it. And there was this lure, this carrot, so to speak. You know, they were going to give me $20,000 to go. And I think that that plays, you know, in the absence of quality public education, quality free public education, free access to higher institutions of learning, people find themselves kind of stuck in these situations where they, you know, even when they question the role of the state, the role of U.S. imperialism, they find themselves aiding it just so that they can survive or continue or make something of themselves. And it came down to sort of the incitement of, like, the worst aspects of being a man in society, right? The worst aspects of masculinity, of violence and daring and all of this stuff where you would be willing to kill or be killed, and it doesn't really matter. You know, there's no explanation. In fact, you do what you're told. You don't need an explanation. Explanations are something even probably the American people don't need, right? I mean, I think we've heard George Bush insist he wouldn't conduct a war like they had in Vietnam, right? There would be no explanation. The public would be the last thing that is on his mind in terms of what he does for his war policy.
Another thing that I know of through some research and through talking to people that was going on at the time that you were in the service was this use of experimental weapons. And that wasn't anything new in the Gulf War, but there was a new type of weapon used called depleted uranium. And many link this to what's called Gulf War Syndrome. And I'm wondering if you've had any experience talking to other veterans about the use of experimental weapons such as DU and the onset of Gulf War Syndrome.
Well, it's interesting because the unit I was in and my actual job drove what was called a Bradley fighting vehicle. It's a kind of a small tank, and we used these kinds of weapons, depleted uranium rounds. It's made out of depleted uranium so that it's more damaging, causes more damage to the enemy target or whatever vehicle or whatever you're shooting. But they put this stuff in our vehicles on a daily basis, and this was in South Korea well after the war was over, and we just handled it like it was ordinary stuff. So, you know, there was a little concern about health and welfare of soldiers. In fact, there was kind of a sense that we were being experimented on. And that wasn't even during the wartime. The men that I did know that served in the Gulf and talked to about their experiences did remark just how overwhelming the force they have. And it was partially a result of some of these things. They could simply just destroy enemy tanks with one round, you know, and it's just devastating. They were even surprised how devastating they could inflict damage on people. But at the same time, even people that I met later who seemed to come through it all right and talked about the personal sort of health problems and emotional problems they experienced as a result. I didn't necessarily meet anybody that personally that was severely damaged, but people talked about their inability to sleep at night and their anxieties and a lot of things that are not only associated with post-traumatic stress, but also with the specific symptoms of Gulf War Syndrome. But as I understand it, there have been a number of thousands of veterans of the Persian Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War, who have died since it. And that's, you know, that's only a 10-year period, 10 or 11-year period. Yeah, it's something that's not heavily acknowledged by the U.S. government. So, and my advice, try to find out what you're using. Ask questions. You people who are service members who are worried about whether or not they're using something that might be damaging their health have, you know, they have a recourse. They don't get to just use your body for whatever they want. You can contact your inspector general. You can talk to people outside of the service, in the media or whatnot, about your concerns and your fears. And you can talk to your congressional representative. That's not, you know, that's certainly not something that the service encourages. In fact, some of them will get very angry if you try to talk outside of the service about what's going on. But it is a health and safety issue. You know, it's a workplace issue. If you want to talk about it on that basic level, if you feel as though that they may be endangering your health, you certainly have a right. You have a responsibility to yourself and to other people. Get them to stop doing that.
I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about the money that is being spent on the military. Recently, according to the Congressional Budget Office, something like $100 to $200 billion will be spent on a possible war in Iraq. I'm wondering what else we could do possibly with the money that is being spent on the military.
Well, that's a crucial question because it seems to have been the main policy of the Bush administration, right, to provide big tax cuts for the rich, the very already very, very rich and extremely successful corporations, and even those corporations that seem to be doing badly, and providing large amounts of tax dollars for military-based corporations, the Boeings, the Lockheed Martins, the Raytheons, and so on and so on. And right now, the estimate is that we will be spending more money than every single other country in the world for our military. In fact, we're expected to be spending upwards of $400 billion, and the closest country behind us in their expenditures is Russia, with about $50 to $60 billion this year. So it's an extraordinary, unprecedented amount. It boggles one's mind if one tries to wrap one's brain around that much money, right? As I mentioned before, we have trouble providing enough public schools, providing enough teachers, providing good salaries for teachers, providing for health care for the elderly, right? Where there's this big debacle in the U.S. Congress about prescription drug benefits. You know, people are hurting. I know people who are paying an arm and a leg, literally, you know, hundreds of dollars every week to try to purchase the prescription drugs they need to survive, just to live, right, and to feel less pain, etc. And that money is available. There is enough resources in this country to provide that. But it seems to be the policy of the Bush administration that building weapons of mass destruction is more important than saving people's lives anywhere in the world, here or in any other country in the world. Take, for example, South Africa, you know, cutting way back on the amount of funding for fighting AIDS, you know, and other diseases, right? Those are some basic things, right? Healthcare, education, you know, the students that are probably walking around campus at WSU and other places, sitting in their dorm rooms, are probably quite angry that they've seen their tuition rates go up and up and up, all in the name of having more money available for things like tax cuts for the rich and building this super enormous and wildly unprecedented and wildly unnecessary military-industrial complex, as they used to call it, right? So those are some basic things. Certainly, there's a big need to replace oil as a source of energy, funding ways to develop things such as wind and solar power and other kinds of energy sources that can help us move our vehicles around, turn our lights on, etc. And without needing to go to different parts of the world and kill people to get that stuff out of the ground. Those are just some basic needs, you know, that people, even in this rich country, right, that people need. And people around the world need too, and there are just so much better things to put that money toward, rather than more destruction and more killing and more death.
Well, earlier you mentioned an imperialist agenda, and I think that's exactly what you're talking about right now. I'm wondering if you could break down for our listeners what you mean by an imperialist agenda.
I think what happens in a capitalist system is there's certain limits to what it can do in any given geographical area. In the United States is a pretty big place, but even though there it has its limits, and as we all know, right, going back to the example of oil, we don't really have enough of it in our geographical area. We don't control enough land that under which there's enough oil for us to run our millions of cars and SUVs and Dodge Ram pickup trucks and whatnot. So there's a need, right? Oil companies find a need to find ways to get at that stuff. In order to do so, they find they have to go to other countries, and of course they don't want to go to other geographical areas and then other countries and deal with people on an even playing field, because profit is the basic thing. So they find that if they can find a way to sort of maneuver themselves into the political life of another country, say, for example, Venezuela, or, Iraq, or wherever, they can get at those resources at a minimum cost to themselves, right? And to sell, right, the policy is buy cheap and sell dear, right? And But often they encounter, right, people, you know, just, you know, who want to be able to control their own resources, who want to be able to control their own lives, who say, no, you know, you can't come here and just dominate us like this. And they choose leaders who will stand up to the United States, and they will, you know, people like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela is trying to find ways to develop Venezuela's independence, right, from U.S. imperialism. And the result was one of the first sort of instincts of the Bush administration was to try to have the man replaced, if not killed, right? And thus they ported and engineered a coup last April. I think that's kind of a basic example of how U.S. imperialism operates. Within our own country, it tends to operate by not letting us know, right? Most American citizens don't seem to really know what's going on in the world, and that sort of benefits them. The benefits are our rulers, the wealthy in our country who have a stake in destroying Iraq in order to control its oil, and convincing us that we're doing it, that they're doing it out of the great sense of justice and fair play and whatnot, because Saddam is this evil tyrant and so killing tens of thousands of people in Iraq to get at their oil is a justified thing. They want us to believe. You know, it's our responsibility, you know, as people who are born and or come to a democratic society to learn about the issue, find out what's really going on, and then make a stand and say, no, this is not a democratic procedure, right? It's violent and it hurts humans here, people from the United States. It hurts people in Iraq, and it only destroys the things, human beings, and it destroys the things that human beings make, and it just destroys nature. And it's all so that a few small select group of people can make large amounts of money. But we have a responsibility to make a stand against that. What we're seeing, I think, is a return to a sort of a long tradition, probably throughout the 20th century. The United States ruling class has played in various parts of the world, and that is to install governments that are friendly in places where we need resources. And once those resources are used up, or once we find that we don't have a need there anymore, we abandon it, right? And Afghanistan is a perfect case in point of that. I don't think there's a single part of the world that the United States hasn't tried to wield its imperial influence, whether, you know, through the back channels or through just outright military attack, assassinations and whatnot. One of the very first things that the Bush administration did, and the Republican Party, in fact, in Congress, was oppose, right? There's this belief, right? We have this belief that veterans and support the Republicans all the time, and they're very conservative people. Well, you know, in some cases that's true, but one of the very first things that the Republicans did and the Bush administration did after getting into office was oppose increased funding for health care. And if there's one thing that veterans need, right, because they usually are, for the most part, are working-class people, is health care. The Republicans and the Bush administration called it big spending and opposed it. And I think that's the general attitude of that particular party and its leadership. Especially in the extreme right wing of its leadership, is that they are quite willing to send people off to fight wars, to secure oil and territory and political prestige and influence in certain parts of the world. But they, you know, if you look carefully at their records, they are people that didn't, when they were asked, when it was time for them to go, right, they didn't go. They used their money and their influence to avoid it, for the most part. And that's one thing. And then the other is that they, in the spirit of capitalism and making profits and reserving the nation's resources for big tax cuts and military spending, not for health care. They are fairly consistent in their policies that hurt people, right? Hurt people who are poor, hurt people who are working class, hurt people who don't have a lot of resources. And I think that's integral to this whole thing. I mean, you know, people don't automatically rise up and say, you know, I'm opposing this war, but then they kind of connect things together, right? Just when you step back and look at the big picture and look at the willingness of the Bush administration to throw money, just throw it left and right at big corporations, at the very rich, and at the military corporations, I think that's central to it. And there's also a certain knowledge. There's definitely assert knowledge. The most loyal, the most patriotic, and, you know, and I consider myself patriotic and loyal, but the people that are the most willing to sacrifice themselves also are the ones with the most knowledge about what war does to people, to themselves, to their friends, to people that they meet. I knew of a guy who I didn't necessarily consider overly sympathetic about anybody, who talked about his experience in the Persian Gulf War, and he broke down because he talked about meeting Iraqi soldiers who were desperate, were destitute, were without shoes and clothes, and were sick and hadn't eaten anything in days, and there was kind of a sense of humanity, even though he was part of this process of creating this destruction. Right? He could still feel something about other human beings, and I think there's something to that. I think veterans are in a perfect kind of location where they, all of these things, sort of come together, and they are more and more kind of waking up with the rest of us, right? Way we're all waking up to these realities.
Well, and as we're seeing with all this talk about biological weapons, there is a biological weapons treaty that is being discussed by the UN, and the U.S. is doing just about everything it can to scuttle those negotiations. I'm wondering, what are some of the alternatives to war that are being discussed?
Within the United States, we have to, one of the things that we have to do is continue to organize people, continue to march in the streets, continue to make a voice, writing letters to the newspapers, writing our own newspapers, perhaps, building that movement. And I think one of the things that we can also do is we can reach out to the international community and find ways to build alliances in the international community to convince other governments that, you know, standing up to the United States is something that they have a responsibility to do too. You know, countries like Germany, countries like China, countries like Russia, France, that instead of being cynical about their so-called opposition to this war and looking for ways to make their own gains, their own sort of imperialist gains, so to speak, they have to oppose it. They have to really legitimately oppose it. And I think we can do that by building bridges with people around the world, just like us, who are saying, hey, wait a sec, you know, so stop this insanity. This is going to get us all killed. So I think that's a big, strong peace movement, I think, is the biggest, the best possible alternative to war. Looking more long-term, long-range, building institutions and relationships with other countries that generate equal exchange, cooperative arrangements, rather than these one-sided, dominating relationships that countries like the United States tend to prefer, that undermine the ability of countries to provide for themselves, that encourage the rise of these right-wing tyrants that the U.S. also seems to prefer, at least for a time, right? Like some of the people you mentioned earlier. And you know, making those kinds of demands on our own government and on other governments. We have to build equal cooperative relationships between nations in order to avoid a lot of these conflicts that just seem to come out of nowhere for many of us who are down here on the bottom of our society.
This concludes our interview with Joe Wendland from Veterans for Peace. For more information, you can go to the internet at www.veteransforpeace.org. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society with economic and social justice for all. If you would like to contact the League or learn more about our other print and media publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888. That's 1-800-691-6888. Or on the internet at www.lrna.org. My name is Jesus Estrada, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.